Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Greetings, and welcome to this new episode of New Books Network. My name is Joaquin Rivaya Martinez. I am an associate professor of history at Texas State University and will be the host of this interview. Today, we will be chatting with Cynthia Radding about her book, Bountiful Deserts, Sustaining Indigenous Worlds in Northern New Spain, recently published by the University of Arizona Press. I am particularly glad to interview Dr. Radding today because her influential work, Wandering Peoples, is one of the first history books I read when I was in graduate school. And I have always enjoyed and learned quite a bit from her scholarship. And in recent years, I've had the opportunity to collaborate with her on a couple of projects as we share academic interests in indigenous peoples, borderlands, the environment, etc. So good morning from San Marcos, Texas, Cynthia, and welcome to New Books Network. Thank you for being with us.
Good morning, Joaquin. Thank you very much for inviting me to this very pleasant conversation. And I appreciate so much the opportunity to talk about the work and the interests that you and I share and to talk about my book.
All right. So Dr. Cynthia Radding is the Guggenhoven Distinguished Professor of History and Latin American Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Her scholarship is rooted in the imperial borderlands of the Spanish and Portuguese American empires and emphasizes the roles of indigenous peoples and other colonized groups in sharing those borderlands, in shaping those borderlands, transforming their landscapes, and producing colonial societies. She is past president of the Conference on Latin American History, affiliated with the American Historical Association. She has served on the editorial boards of several journals, including the American Historical Review, the Hispanic American Historical Review, the Americas. Dr. Radding is president of the board of directors of the Americas Research Network and is co-editor with Dana Levin-Rojo of the Oxford Handbook of Borderlands of the Iberian World. In addition to numerous journal articles, her publications include the aforementioned Wandering Peoples, published by Duke University Press in 97, Landscapes of Power and Identity, Comparative Histories in the Sonoran Desert and the Forests of Amazonia from Colony to Republic, published by Duke University Press in 2005, Borderlands in World History, co-edited with Chad Bryant and Paul Redman, published by Palgrave in 2014, and most recently, Bountiful Deserts, Sustaining Indigenous Worlds in Northern New Spain, which is the book that we're about to discuss, published this year by University of Arizona Press. So, Cynthia, tell our audience a little bit about yourself. For instance, how you became a historian and where does your interest in the indigenous peoples of northwestern Mexico come from?
Thank you, Joaquin. The decision to become an historian began with my undergraduate education, where I completed my bachelor's degree at Smith College. And having lived in eastern United States, I had no previous background in Latin America. But I decided to major in history and to develop two concentrations in early modern Europe and in Latin America. And it was largely through the influence of one of the professors who was at Smith College at the time, Ramon Ruiz, who had a very distinguished career in the history of Mexico. And it was also the time in which we were living. I was finding ways to combine music and history in my own personal development and in my intellectual development. And I told myself that I wanted to study a developing area of the world. So having studied Latin and French, I then jumped into studying Spanish. And my interest in Latin America and in the indigenous peoples of Latin America, and with a focus on Mexico, came from the opportunities I had to experience life in Mexico directly. During the summer, between my junior and senior years, I joined an American Friends Service Committee, what they called a work camp, in Guanajuato. And this was my first experience with people who at the time probably didn't identify as indigenous, but they were certainly ejidatarios. They were peasants in the rural area of Penjamo of Guanajuato. And then my second really important introduction to the region of northwestern Mexico and to environment and to indigenous peoples was through the first Fulbright grant that I had the privilege of holding, which took me to Sonora for the year after I graduated, after I completed my undergraduate degree. And then later on, after I received the master's degree, I returned to Sonora with my husband, and we began our family and our professional lives there. And I was privileged to be able to work with Mexico's National Institute of Anthropology and History and a regional center that opened in Sonora. And this was really a wonderful opportunity to begin to put into practice some of the skills and some of the methods that I had studied both in undergraduate and during my master's program.
Excellent. So before delving into the details of the book, tell us a little bit about what the process of researching and writing Bountiful Deserts was like.
Yes, it was a combination of archival research, over a period of years, and also visiting directly the area on which this book is centered. Let me explain a little bit. After I worked, during the time, I was working at INAH, the Instituto Nacional de Antropología e Historia, and I had begun to become interested in what later would be called environmental history through studies that I did in geography at University of California, Berkeley, and then through my work and living in what is the area of the Sonoran Desert in Hermosillo. The first book that you are kind enough to mention came out of my doctoral dissertation, which I completed then some years later at the University of California in San Diego. And the doctoral dissertation became Wandering Peoples, which centered on what today is central and northern Sonora in parts of Arizona. And the Wandering Peoples were largely the Oram and Opata peoples of that portion of Sonora. And then Landscapes of Power and Identity was my adventure into comparative history, keeping one column in northwestern Mexico and turning to eastern Bolivia, where I asked the specific question, what difference do ecology and geography make in historical processes? Comparing the provinces again of Sonora and Chiquitos in eastern Bolivia. And for this book, Bountiful Deserts, I came back to Sonora, but now to the portion more in the south, from the Yaqui to the Sinaloa rivers between what today are the states of Sonora and Sinaloa. And to your question about how to research it, it's a combination of archival research, again in Sonora, in Mexico City, in the Archivo General de la Nación, in the Biblioteca Nacional, with the archive, the Franciscan archive, and the reserved, the Fondo Reservado, the reserved archive in Mexico's National Library. And then, of course, a number of archival and library collections in the United States and in Europe. I did work in the Archivo General de Indias and in the British Library, where there are a number of wonderful maps dealing with the Spanish imperial world. This combined with time spent in the region itself. And it's really been a privilege for me. What I have done with this book, Bountiful Deserts, is delve more deeply into some of the particular questions of environmental history and also ethnography, and to work directly with indigenous communities in the region where I've studied. I've been very fortunate to be able to learn so much from indigenous communities in all three of these kind of major books that I've undertaken. In Wandering Peoples, it was more with the Tohono O'odham of present-day Sonora and Arizona. In Chiquitos, it was with the Chiquitano indigenous peoples in Bolivia. And here I've really had the closest opportunity to collaborate with indigenous communities in the Mayo River Valley and to learn from them, to bring to them the work that some of the information that I found in the archives, to ask them about the names of plants, about some of the toponyms that I found in the archival records, to share this material with them, and then to learn from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find extremely interesting, as always, your interdisciplinary methodology involving cultural geography, anthropology, archaeology, and so forth. But I think in this book, one of the most outstanding aspects of the methodology is this collaborative research that you did with extant communities, right? In particular, can you tell us a little bit about the Pueblo of Cowirimpo?
Yes, I'm very happy to. I was able to visit the Pueblo of Cowirimpo and began a relationship with two of the people in the gobierno tradicional, the traditional government of Cowirimpo, which exists through the selection of the people themselves and in a kind of parallel fashion with the two municipal governments of the small cities of Navajoa and Echehoa. I went there in 2017, invited to give a talk in an encuentro that had been organized by the Instituto Nacional de Antropología e Historia and that Gobierno Tradicional in Cowirimpo. Cowirimpo itself, as Navajoa, Echehoa, Santa Cruz, Tesia, and Camoa, are today living towns along the Mayo River, and they were part of the eight mission towns that Mayo indigenous peoples founded together with the Jesuits beginning in the early 17th century. So each of these towns has a very deep historical past. And of course, these were Mayo or Yureme indigenous villages before Europeans came there. And under the organizational kind of umbrella of the Jesuit missions, it's true that these towns became more populated, more concentrated in population as the smaller rancherias came to live in them. And today, these towns have a very similar pattern of there is a town center and then a fairly large number of communities, what they call comunidades or congregaciones, that live in the area around them. Their configuration now in the 21st century is somewhat more a product of Mexico's post-revolutionary ejido development, but they retain many, many of the traditional elements of their historical past.
Hmm. Yeah, this notion of building an environmental history from below is fascinating, really. So before getting into the nuances of the book, can you briefly tell our listeners what do you mean by bountiful deserts, since it seems a tautology, no? But there's a good reason to make a distinction between just a desert and the type of bountiful deserts that you're discussing here.
Yes, thank you. Yes, the title was intended to be to kind of catch attention, and it is, and it appears to be an immediate contradiction. We in the English language think of desert as a place that is desolate, that is arid, of course, and that is lacking in things like water, productive soil, plant life, and animal life. And in Spanish, desierto refers a little bit more to a place that is deserted, that doesn't have human population. And desiertos can be a tropical swamp as well as an arid desert. Here I was using it in a kind of paradoxical way to say that the deserts are bountiful because people make them bountiful. Now, the specific geographical region, as I explain in the introduction in the first chapter to the book, the specific geographical region extending from the Yaqui River in the north, in again, the southern part of Sonora, to the Sinaloa and even the Mocorito rivers in the state of Sinaloa, is not literally desert. It is certainly arid land. And this is an area that covers the kind of southern borderland of the Sonoran Desert, which is an identified geographical figure that includes Sonora, Arizona, and portions of Baja California. But these are all arid lands that in fact do have a rainy season and do have rivers flowing through them. The rivers gather their water from the Sierra Madre Occidental and flow from the Sierra, basically from the northeast to the southwest, flowing into the Gulf of California. And what distinguishes them is what in Spanish is called the monte. This is a word that is used very frequently, as you know, Joaquin, in Spain itself, as well as throughout Latin America, to refer to uncultivated types of vegetation that can extend from thorn forest to chaparral to pine and oak forests in the upper reaches of the Sierra. But these are lands that are not planted in domesticated crops. Nevertheless, they are shaped by human populations that hunt and gather in them, that select plants, that transplant plants, and that generally shape these montes. Over the last 2.5 centuries or so, these montes also have been turned to pasture lands for cattle. And this has, by both indigenous and Hispanic and later on Mexican ranchers, and this has changed much of the composition of the vegetation in these areas. One of the questions, Joaquin, that around which I structured the book is how to research and how to write about these areas that are not completely domesticated or cultivated and not completely wild. And this is why I chose the four kind of families of plants around which I structured the first chapter.
Right. Actually, I was going to ask you specifically about that now. The first part of your book deals with the cultural resilience of Aboriginal peoples through the production of landscapes. So tell us, tell us briefly who these native peoples are, the Yoremem and the Yoemem, and how they adapted to the distinct environments of the floodplains of the Mayo River and also to the Monte.
Yes, I'll be very happy to. And in a way, I would like to start with a phrase that I learned from the Mayo peoples of Corinto, which is Yoremia Yorekame, Patwe Mayo Amaki, which means we, the Yoreme people, the true Yoreme people, born on the banks of the Mayo River. And I think this is a beautifully poetic way to express their sense of identity, very much rooted into the place. Mayo actually does come from their language, and it means on the margins of, on the banks of. Batwe is river or water. And Yoreme are the Mayo peoples that today extend from the Mayo River south into the Fuerte River into Sinaloa. Yoeme are the Yaqui people of the Yaqui River Valley and are very, very well known. Both of these peoples are very well known in the history of Mexico, and there are important communities of Yaqui or Yoeme people who live in Arizona. They today say that Yoreme, which as in so many indigenous languages sort of means the people, but they give it a very special meaning to say that Yoreme are people who are fully human, who know how to live in a good relationship with nature. It is thought in terms of what we know, and there have been not as much research, obviously, in the archaeology of this region as in, say, central Mexico. But through ongoing research done by both North Americans and Mexican archaeologists, some of them associated with the Instituto of Anthropology in both Sinaloa and Sonora, it is pretty well established that the ancestors of the Mayo and Yaqui peoples have been in this region for probably 2,000 years. They've adapted, of course, to different climatic patterns. And in the river valleys, they developed agriculture probably also as long as 2,000 years ago. They are part of the Uto-Aztecan family of languages and therefore have linguistic and cultural ties to the Mesoamerican peoples of central and western Mexico. And this is a... To me, it is an important dimension of their history that I tried to bring out in chapter 2 in terms of how the people came here. And also the cultural exchanges and patterns of migration, but also exchange, how maize probably came to this region through a kind of group-to-group experimentation with Mesoamerican cultigens like zea maíz, cucurbits or squashes, and beans. And so they definitely practiced agriculture, probably floodplain agriculture, taking advantage of the really prodigious and fertile flows of both water and silt that come down the river seasonally with the summer rains. The very first Jesuits who entered this region in the very late 16th and early 17th centuries, all of them in their early letters and reports emphasized the prodigious productivity of this area. And all of them emphasized that the indigenous peoples were able to gather two crops a year. Now, their adaptation to the monte is equally important, and it is something that today the Yoreme peoples emphasize. The monte is their pharmacopoeia. It is the source of medicine. It also used to be their, and until very recently, and in a way still is, their source of hunting. Deer are both sacred animals and animals that are hunted for meat and for their hides, as well as other smaller animals. And there's a whole profusion of plants, of cacti, thorn forest, agaves, other kinds of plants that the carrizo, which is very important, that they use for construction materials, for medicinal materials, and as sources of food through their seeds, their flowers, and their roots.
Right. So how do the Yoreme define territory and their own ethnic identity?
Well, the Yoreme define their territory. They define their identity. Let me begin there. As I said, through their spiritual belief that Yoreme is to have a respectful and sustainable relationship with their environment in terms of using that environment but not destroying it. And they do define their territory in rather specific ways. The length of the river itself Which extends for several hundred kilometers from the Sierra Madre to the coast of the Gulf of California, but also both the Yuremim and the Yuemim, they don't claim the territory without limits. They claim their territory in terms of certain mountain ranges and mountain peaks that surround the area, and they also are respectful of one another's territory to the north and to the south. But they do live, at the present time, they live in tension with the private properties of agribusiness that surround their communities, and that, quite frankly, are taking too often a monopoly of water. So they do live in a tension with the sort of regimen of private property. And what they are trying to do is to defend their areas of communal property around certain resources that include lagunas and include the kind of rivulets that flow into the river itself. Part of what I set out to do in this book and found the documents with which to do it is to document the process of the defense of that territory, including the Wasum, what they call the Wasum, which is the river valley and the arable land, and the Monte, which they call Uya Anya. Anya is world. And in a sense, Anya is the concept with which they define their territory. And what I wanted to lead up to saying is that the way they conceive of their territory is with the expression Itom Anya, our world, our territory, which includes the Wasum, the river valley, Huya Anya, the Monte, and the word Huya Anya expresses the spiritual value of the Monte, Batwe, which is the river, as well as the estuaries and the marine resources of the Gulf of California, which is very important to them, and then Kawi, which are the Sierras. So these are the ways that they define the ecological features and zones and spaces of Itom Anya, our world. And this concept is used also by the Yuemim, or the Yaqui peoples.
Yeah, I was thinking that one aspect of your analysis of the adaptation of these peoples to their environment is that you itself it allows you to problematize the distinction that people tend to make between nomadic and sedentary peoples. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yes, this was the second kind of major question that I wanted to address in this book. And that is to break down a little bit the binary between nomadic versus sedentary, to say, and this is what I also did in Wandering Peoples to an extent, to say that many of these people are both. And the two economies, the two ways of approaching their ecology, their ecological entorno, their environment, are essential to their survival, both physically and culturally, so that they do have villages, they do have rooted communities, but at the same time, during several months of the year, they go out into the monte, and access to these spaces, to these uncultivated spaces, is as important as their continuing access to the floodplains and the river valleys themselves. And so I've tried to break down the idea, which in fact some Mesoamericanists think that northern Mexico is just totally nomadic. This is not true. People, indigenous peoples in many parts of northern Mexico are agriculturalists. They are farmers, very successful farmers. And at the same time, they are using a large variety of resources within the spaces that they claim by moving through them and by living in them. And those spaces include from the water, in this case, the Gulf of California, deep into the Sierra.
Right. And there is also a seasonality, no, to the utilization of these resources.
Yes, yes.
You also dispel the notion that native peoples, I mean, quite often, one of the most widespread images of native nowadays is the idea of the environmentalist indigenous person, right? In what ways do you think that people like the Yuremen and the Yuemen are different from the typical idea that the average American has of an environmentalist?
Yes, I was trying to say that our notion of environmentalists, which comes from 20th and 21st century American political activism, in a sense, is something that now is touching indigenous peoples, and that indigenous peoples are participating in, but they do so from their own conceptual framework. Now, I was also making distinction. The book Bountiful Deserts is itself centered in the 17th and 18th and early 19th centuries, but I do continually make the effort in the book to bring its relevance to the present day. But I was making a slightly historical distinction between this earlier period, so that we don't expect people to go around with signs and placards talking about save the environment. But the way of living bespeaks an environmental perception. And again, it's a perception that comes back to this idea of itom anya. And in this sense, I will say that I was also found very useful the ideas developed by a number of anthropologists. One of them is Tim Ingold, who in his 2000 book published in 2000, writes about dwelling in a given landscape, the skills to live in it, and the purposefulness of living in it. And he's saying that indigenous peoples don't separate their conceptual framework from the very material experience of living in a landscape, living in a place which they then shape into landscapes. And this is the message that I also developed in the ways in which I researched and then wrote about Bountiful Deserts.
Mm-hmm. So in part two of the book, titled Internal Frontiers and the Production of Knowledge in Northwestern New Spain, you emphasize change and adaptation and conflict. In what ways did the Spanish intrusion transform the livelihoods and the landscapes of Sonora and Sinaloa, and how did the natives adapt to those changes or actually participate in those transformations?
Yes, of course. The coming of Spanish colonialism did work profound and lasting changes in this region, as in nearly all of New Spain. But the way you phrased your question is the way I have also tried to present this. It is not simply a history of victims and victimizers. This is a history of the development of a colonial society in an imperial borderland in which indigenous peoples participated. And I emphasize that throughout the period in which I am studying and into well into the 19th century, the indigenous peoples are demographically the majority. They are the people who have the most direct knowledge of this region. And from the beginning of Spanish exploration into this region, which I cover in chapter 3, and then into the second part of the book, the Jesuit missionaries, and even the Spanish mining enterprise, which becomes very important in this region, they depend upon indigenous labor, and they depend upon indigenous knowledge of the region and its resources. And I do see the missions, the Jesuit missions, which have a very important imprint for both the Yueme, Yaqui, and Yureme, Mayo peoples. But the missions were not simply a blueprint that the Jesuits imposed on the people and on the landscape. The missions had to be negotiated. and negotiated between the Jesuit missionaries and the indigenous peoples. I don't want to go into too much detail, but the Mayo indigenous peoples accepted the missions after going to the northern river valleys of what today is Sinaloa and observing the missions there. They waited and watched and then made their decision to invite the Jesuits in. The history for the Yaqui peoples is more dramatic. There were pitched battles between the Yaqui Yaquimi warriors and Spanish forces. Spanish forces allied with other indigenous peoples, because it should be said that even though they shared linguistic commonalities and cultural things in common, these different groups were at war with one another. But finally, the Spaniards had to negotiate. The Yaquis defeated them three times, and they finally had to negotiate. And what I write in the book is that I think the Yaquis saw, the Yueme or the Yaquis saw, that they were winning the battles but losing the war, because more and more of these indigenous peoples that surrounded them and to the south of them were lying with the Spaniards. And so they also made a judicious, a counseled, a negotiated decision to agree to allow Jesuit missionaries to come into their zone. Now, there's no question that the Spanish mining economy, which did demand labor, Spanish livestock raising, and the beginnings of Spanish landholding did change ecological relations in the region, probably demanding more and more of the water table. And what I detail, what I research in some detail, particularly in Chapter 5, is the slow but gradual process of the privatization of the monte through the Spanish legal system of composición, which allowed Spaniards, in effect, to take out title to land that de facto they were occupying with their livestock. But an important part of this whole process, and by which we can learn so much, is that indigenous pueblos were represented in these legal documents, and the indigenous agricultural lands and a portion of the monte that surrounded them were recognized as belonging to the indigenous peoples by the Spanish colonial state. And they learn, the indigenous peoples learn, to manage these legal institutions to defend their land. And through their speech, which admittedly is captured in Spanish transcription, but through their presence in the visible public measurement of these lands, we learn about the kinds of resources that were especially important to them. And again, in practice, how they defined and defended their territories.
Right. In the 18th century, though, there were some changes, right, in the allocation of resources that brought about the so-called Yaqui and Mayo rebellions in the mid-18th century, roughly. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, yes. My sixth chapter, The Monte in Flames, in which I borrowed a phrase that I borrowed from Juan Rufo, El Llano en Llamas, El Monte en Llamas. This is, in a sense, this chapter is the most narrative of the chapters in the book. And I do in it tell and retell the story of what was a major rebellion that occurred between 1739 and 1741, and that was building up through the 1730s. And you have captured perfectly well, Joaquin, what I tried to express in the book. I relate the rebellion to what came before, in the chapter before, which is the increased pressure on land and water resources coming from now what is population growth among Spaniards, among indigenous peoples, and the growth of cattle, livestock herds. And also one of the things that I emphasize, other authors have written about this rebellion, and other authors have come to much of the same conclusions, but I emphasize a little bit more than they have that an important turning point in the Jesuit enterprise in this whole region was to divert resources from these missions, particularly the missions of the Yaquis and Mayos in the province, which at the time was called Ostimuri, crossing the Gulf of California and diverting resources of foodstuffs, livestock, and people, laborers, to the missions that the Jesuits felt were so important to them in Baja California. And the missions in Baja California were in much more arid lands and really could not sustain themselves as concentrated villages. And the Yaquis and Mayos seem not to have objected to this. And in fact, for them, it was an opportunity for mobility. It also enhanced kind of their importance in this whole colonial enterprise until their region began to suffer from drought and from scarcities. And it also came down to a question of the Yaqui and Mayo leaders of their village councils, which are the people who we basically see in the documents. They were also asserting their capacity to control and to make decisions over the disposition of the harvests and also over the liturgy and the religious cycle within the missions. And what I do want to emphasize, and I emphasize in the book, this rebellion was not a rejection of Catholicism. It was not a rejection even of the colonial administrative regime. It was, as I say, a resounding outcry. It was a demand to renegotiate that colonial arrangement and an assertion that we now want to control the economic and the social and the cultural lives of our towns. These were people who had been steeped in Catholicism for generations, since the early 17th century, for a century and a half. And also the indigenous leaders had a very strong sense that they were vassals of the king. And they had a direct line, and as vassals of the king, they had a direct line to the royal authority and to make their claims upon the Spanish state within their region. And they also had, and this is something that has continued with the indigenous peoples in this region, and I think throughout Mexico, and even in other parts of Latin America, a very strong sense of local governance. And what they were defending was the integrity of being able to select their own officers at the level of local governance.
Right. So what have been, in your view, the long-term effects of the processes that you analyze in the book? For instance, what is left of the aboriginal and colonial landscapes that you discuss? And how do contemporary Yoreme and Yoreme communities respond to environmental threats and political disruptions?
Okay, that's a big question. But I want to take the first part first. I think much remains of the indigenous and colonial roots in this region. The symbols of the cross, the very, and all the houses among both the Yoemem and Yoremem, especially among the Yoremem, all the houses have a patio cross. And this cross is a very important center for family life, for the preparation of food, and also for the kinds of religious ceremonies that take place within the houses, what they call pajco, which are ceremonies that involve the reverence to the saints, but also involve dances and songs that bring blessings and prosperity and health. These largely have to do with ceremonies to bring or to restore health. And they are household ceremonies as well as community ceremonies. The rather famous Lenten and Holy Week, very elaborate rituals, are the development of Catholicism reworked and maintained by the indigenous peoples themselves. And this is, and I was able to find ethnographic references to this even in the 18th century documents. And this was also one of the aspects that I tried to emphasize in my history of the 1740 rebellion, was that the liturgical life and the religious symbolism continued along with it. This is a very important part of Yueme and Yoreme life today. Also, living with the river, continuing to practice agriculture, and defending the resources of the monte. The changes that have come, the really great inflection points that the Yoreme and Yueme peoples today are very much aware of, have really occurred within the last century. And these are the post-revolutionary developments from the revolution, the Mexican Revolution of 1910, and its outcome. These two river valleys underwent very intense commercial development and exploitation from the late 19th century into the 20th century through sophisticated hydraulic technology, the construction of dams on both rivers that have diverted water into what is the commercial agriculture of this area. And within the modern economy, this area is part of the breadbasket of Mexico. It was the area in which in the 1940s, the Mexican Green Revolution was developed, in which ejidatarios participated. And some of these ejidatarios are in fact indigenous people. But at the same time, the struggle, and particularly after the reversal of land reform that came at the end of the 20th century with the presidencies of Salinas de Gortari and the turn to neoliberalism crossing into the 21st century, these have brought great hardship to the indigenous ejidatarios and to the indigenous peoples, and some of them are in Coatimpo, who have chosen to maintain more a communal approach to land than to enter into the ejidos themselves. But both have suffered the aggressive advancement of private agriculture, private agribusiness that I referred to earlier in our conversation. And as happens in many parts of Mexico and in Latin America, the threat to the continued communal life of the people today comes from the fact that they can no longer support themselves with traditional agriculture. They do not have the resources of land and water to do so. Many are working in these maquiladoras, or these assembly plants that are now concentrated in Navajoa. Men and women have to go into wage labor to support their families, which, as also has happened in the United States, with hardworking working class people who receive a very low salary, all the adults are working. This leaves the children with less of a supportive family life. There is much concern about this. And this is what I've learned by continuing to visit and continuing to collaborate with the people in Coatimpo. And if there's time, I can tell you a little bit about the work we're doing now, but to which I'm contributing in a very modest way, and work that has really been undertaken by the traditional government of Coatimpo in an attempt to shore up the family life and the community life.
Please tell us more about that.
Well, the modest contribution that we are making through the Americas Research Network. And you were kind enough to say at the beginning of this, I'm on the board of directors of the Americas Research Network, and we have devoted some of our funds to a project of language revitalization. And this has come about through a book to which I was introduced by one of the members of the Coatimpo Town Council, that the town of Coatimpo, with the help of some of the NGOs in Mexico and in Guadalajara, published 10 years ago in 2011 and brought out a second edition in 2014, which in Spanish reads, Una espina es un bosque de advertencias. A thorn is a forest of warnings or lessons. And this was a series of conversations gathered over 2 years among seven counselors of Corimpo, both men and women, and then laboriously written down by one of the council members and written down in Spanish. And it is an utterly beautiful book that expresses philosophy, this relationship with nature, and that insists on the importance of good governance. And the phrase that I recited to you at the beginning of my book, Lloreme, Llorecame, Batwe, Mayuamaki, comes from that book. So I thought that this existed in the Yoremnoki language. It turns out that it doesn't. But in consultation with one of the council members, who is herself a school teacher, I said, would you be interested in trying to recover this or produce it in Yoremnoki? And we met with some of the elders in some of the communities that surround Corimbo that are part of its kind of political jurisdiction. And they said, yes, that they would want to do this. And these are people who, people our age, Joaquin, who do speak the language. But of course, as has happened with so many of indigenous communities, the young children who go to school tend much more to speak in Spanish. So we have been able to begin producing small passages from the book in Yoremnoki, both in written text and in recorded voice. And we have begun, it's not quite systematic, but we've begun workshops and little after-school classes for children in the homes of some of the women that live in the communities to begin practicing a little bit more the language of Yoremnoki. And this is something that we want to continue with them. And they see this as part of their effort to strengthen and reinforce the Yoreme identity, and also as a contribution to their efforts to defend their territory.
Wow, that's a terrific initiative. Well, Cynthia, thank you very much for your explanations. What are you working on now? Do you have any ongoing research projects or prospective projects?
Well, two things. And just let me say that the effort really is coming from the Yoreme people. And we in the Americas Research Network are finding ways to network with similar efforts in Mexico through CIESAS, for example, the Center for Research in Social Anthropology in Mexico, and to find ways to get funding to continue and to expand this program. So this is one of the things that this book and the experience of doing it have led me into. And one of the things that I want to continue that's very important to me is the collaboration with these indigenous communities, sort of in the nucleus of Corimbo, the people that I now consider my friends, and also to be able to contribute to this work. Also through the contacts that I've made in the National University, UNAM, in Mexico, I'm continuing to participate in collaborative publications, some of them dealing with Jesuit science, and others of them dealing with this work with the people in Corimbo. And the collaboration that I'm doing with you, Joaquin, and the book that you are editing is also, for me, a very important part of my continued work in this area and my professional development. And I'm also working on a project that I've come into returning to, which is to explore some of these same themes for the colonial period of southeastern New Mexico, in the area that was called the province of Salinas, that is east of the Rio Grande and the major pueblos there, an area that combined Humano and Tompiro indigenous peoples, also a borderland, and also an area that is at the same time semi-nomadic and sedentary. So I look forward to continuing archival research on that. It also is an area that has been much studied, but I'm combining what is known about that region through archaeology, through ethnohistory and environmental history, and then I want to expand the archival base for answering some questions about this region in the 17th century prior to the famous Pueblo Revolt, but also seeing its chronological and spatial relationships farther back in time, a little bit forward in time, and this area, which sometimes is called the Galisteo Basin, its relationship to the Rio Grande Valley, and then eastward into the southern Great Plains.
Right. A lot of Comanche rock art in the Galisteo Basin, by the way.
Yes, yes. I want to learn much more about this from you.
So it has been a pleasure to chat with you, Cynthia, as usual. Thank you very much for sharing with our audience of New Books Network some of the nuances of your book and your research. Good luck with your new projects. I'm looking forward to reading about the Salinas Pueblos. And I look forward to interviewing you again soon.
Thank you, Joaquin, very much for giving me this opportunity. And I thank all of our listeners. And I look forward to more communication and to sharing my work and to learning from all of you. Thank you, Joaquin. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cynthia. And to all of you, many thanks for listening to New Books Network. Kindest regards, and I'll say goodbye for the present.